Session number 22123, Rule 6.
Alan Mavery, Rule 6.
Yeah, I've got a small piece of shrapnel in the leg, which I wasn't particularly conscious of at the time, I must confess. But eventually got back to the position, took the radio set off my back to find a massive great piece of shrapnel embedded in the wireless set. So I was extremely glad for once that I was carrying one of these things. The next situation, I think, was when we went back into the I think I ought to just dwell very briefly on some of the reserve areas that we went into, rather than do it after each particular episode of leaving the line. One typical area was the biggest one. It was a place called Camp Casey, and to this day it's still there, I know that. The whole of the brigade, in fact, there were several brigades, there were Americans there as well, used to go there. And they used to use these as rest areas, training areas, and what have you. And one of the American regiments, I believe it was the, what they call themselves, the Indian Head Cavalry Division. And their tented encampments were like nothing you've ever seen. I mean, they were absolutely beautiful, flowers and whatever, and everybody had polished tin helmets and goodness knows what else. Had their regiment on both sides of the road, the sort of dirt highway, and right the way across from one side of the road was the other, was their regimental motto, or divisional motto. The Indian Head Cavalry Division, the motto, second to none. And just as you were leaving their encampment, there was a very small, two-tented arrangement for the Royal New Zealand Royal Artillery unit. They used to have these spotter units all over the place. And it literally consisted of four men and a couple of tents. And across the road was the Royal New Zealand, a banner with Royal New Zealand Royal Artillery Regiment. None was their motto. It was something that used to rile the Americans, and I thought it was going to cause another diplomatic incident, but it stayed there all the time that we went backwards and forwards. It was there. Again, Camp Casey used to be in one of the fallback areas in case the Chinese ever did make another big push, and in case the UN was forced to withdraw, then Camp Casey was going to be one of the lines to be occupied. I think they called it the Kansas Line or something like that. So we used to periodically have to go out and dig trenches. And that was the main preoccupation in life there, was digging a trench. And I found the remnants of a body, a skeleton. It was Oriental, it wasn't UK. And such was my macabre humour at the time, it had got obviously been shot with a bullet hole straight between the eyes, that I got this thing out of the trench and done my Yorick hack. Ah, behold, Yorick. And for some peculiar reason, which I'm sure I would find disgusting nowadays, I kept this as a keepsake. And wherever we went, then Yorick came with us. And again, a sign of the times, I'm sure that would not be allowed nowadays. I'm quite convinced somebody would have stopped us from doing it. It eventually was painted green. And wherever the signal company or signal platoon were, then so Yorick used to appear. One aspect I think of life in the reserve situations was where certainly people like the signal platoon could actually get together, because we were all split up amongst different companies and different jobs, and so we never actually functioned really as a unit together. And so it was nice to get back out of the line to actually meet up with the chums and have a few beers and what have you. Because in the infantry companies, we were very much isolated. We weren't the infantry guys. We didn't work with them. We only worked with the officers, with the OCs, and that was okay. But I didn't realise until after a while how really isolated we were. But again, for me, that was similar to the way we used to operate in the SAS anyway. Never got to know anybody, never got really to know the regiment as such. You knew your own platoon and your own stick, patrol stick you knew. And here was virtually the same. And when, I suppose, one of the most significant parts of the line as far as the Commonwealth Division was concerned, the highest point was a hill called 355. It was also known as Little Gibraltar, because from one particular side it actually did look very much like the Gibraltar outline. And incidentally, the whole of Korea, to my memory, was that it was extremely hilly. Yes, there were plains, there were paddy plains, but most of it was hills. Very high mountains in the north, but where we were, not significantly high, but they were always so damn steep. To try and get up these things, it was terrible. And it was, if you can imagine, a field, most of which was covered in mole heaps, was very much like the terrain would be there. And Little Gibraltar certainly was no exception. The back of the hill, back away from the line, was very, very, very steep. And in fact, some early people there had attempted to set up what we called a flying fox, a series of gantries and wire pulleys to get stuff from the bottom of the hill. The supply point was at the bottom of the hill, up to where all the company positions were on the top. Wasn't working when we got there, and so I got the approval that I could get a couple of guys in with my engineering background, see if we could get it going again, which we did. And on one of these occasions, I was working at the bottom of the hill trying to get the donkey engine to work, and a jeep came along the dusty track, out of which stepped an immaculately dressed American, a lieutenant, beautiful clothes on, all pressed. He'd obviously come from somewhere and that had all this this facility, and a lovely, nice blue cravat. And he came striding across, held his hand out, and he said, "Hi, I'm Orlando Campisi. I guess you've heard about me. I've been in Time magazine." I'd never heard of the guy. And eventually, when we sorted things out, he had indeed been in Time magazine. And God bless his cotton socks, because I told him quite bluntly we'd never heard of him. He sent me a copy of Time magazine with his story in. And he had his thumb shot off during a battle, and taken back to one of these mashes. And one of the surgeons there had immediately removed the little finger from his damaged hand and grafted it back on to where his thumb was, because the hand without a thumb is a pretty useless device. And so they decided to sacrifice his little finger and put that in place of his thumb. And it actually worked. Quite phenomenal. And it's pretty impressive when you consider that this was done really under the, I wouldn't say primitive conditions, but not far off. The surgeon also made his name out of it as well. Life on 355, we had two postings there. The first time, D Company was the reserve company. The reserve company was actually right on the very, very top, the highest point. And you could see just about everything in the Commonwealth Brigade line from there. And it was quite something. The one of the company positions, though, was one of these positions where it was only 100 yards at the most away from the Chinese positions, and that was quite a hairy situation. And for the signalers, it was doubly so, because they used to have outposts, listening posts, that used to be occupied by one or two guys during the night. And they would go out taking their little field telephones with them when it got dark, and they would go out and they would connect up the telephones and make sure that it was all working back to the company headquarters. And if it wasn't working, it was the poor old signaller who had to go out and sort out the wire. And if you can imagine being pitch black on your own, wandering along a trench, trying to find broken wires or taking out a new cable, to a point where everybody's nerves are on edge, and sort of saying, if you hear a rustle, it's only me, and hoping that it wasn't some Chinese guy sort of roaming around, because they used to try and get behind us quite a lot. And I think if I ever got white hair, it would have been through periods like that. The we had our worst attack, actually, on the Durhams had their worst situation on 355 during our second occupation, and D Company was in fact in this very forward position, and the bombardment started just after dusk, and it went on for quite a few hours, getting heavier and heavier and heavier, and it was pretty obvious something was going to happen. All the telephone lines went out; we could only communicate by radio, and then the actual attack started. And the Chinese were using a method they often used to use. They had two forms of bombardment: one in front of their advancing troops, and one behind. The one behind was obviously to stop the guys at the back from turning tail and going. The South Koreans used to use that as well, which not too good for morale, I suppose, but never mind. And one of our platoons was pretty well overrun, and but we managed to fight it all off. And I remember, again, it's funny how one remembers the old comic remark that comes out. I was saying to Scott that all of our telephone communications were now defunct. And he said, oh dear, he said, tell me, what's the second line after Our Father which art in heaven? And he was as calm as that. And I thought that was pretty good. So, yes, we survived. We had quite a few firefights around us. We got involved in a few. And they must have known where the headquarters part of the company was, but and we all deduced afterwards that they were trying to break over this one of the spurs, and if they could have broken over that, they could have quite clearly got behind the regiment, and that's why they didn't try and come up over the top of the hill. Didn't satisfy their purpose. But anyway, we survived, and it was a horrendous sight when morning broke, because I've never seen so many bodies in all my life. There must have been, I don't know, I mean, hundreds, certainly, hundreds of bodies, all just lying around. And when we debriefed afterwards, I remember guys being punch drunk, if you like, just through killing. I mean, the more you killed, there were still more behind, and so on. They used to attack in such waves. The other frightening thing, I think, is the knowledge that only the forward waves ever had arms. And the secondary waves used to come along and pick up the arms of the guys that had been killed in front of them. The regiment picked up and certainly the company picked up quite a few medals during that particular operation. It was written up by one of the officers into a history which is now in the regimental archives, and it's called A Midsummer Night's Dream, because it pretty well happened round about Midsummer Night. And I think I was not shell-shocked in the old sense of the word, but any sort of slight bang after that, and I was twitchy for quite a long time afterwards. And again, I think if I draw a comparison with, if one can prefer, if that's the right term, which would you prefer, being in Malaya or Korea? I think I'd, accepting the problems with the tinea and what have you, I think I would have settled for Malaya any day of the week. And again, there was going back to we used to clear as many of the bodies as possible, but there was almost, I wouldn't say there was an absolute, but there was almost an understanding about clearing bodies away, that the Chinese would come and take theirs away. There were nasty rumours coming out from some of the American lines, and it did happen with one or two of our people, where if there had been a firefight and one or two people had been killed and their bodies were left there, that they would be booby-trapped, that a hand grenade would be have the pin taken out and put underneath the body so that the thing didn't go off until the body was moved. Now, that had certainly happened in many instances in with the Americans. And it had started to happen in the Commonwealth Division, but it never got very, very far.
Who did and the booby trapping?
We presumed it was the Chinese. Well, it would have been the Chinese and North Koreans. And that was... We were warned never to take reprisals like that. And if we saw a stretcher party, we were to leave them. And we did. In many instances, you'd see their stretcher parties coming out, and we'd just leave them to it. Now, whether that, as I say, introduced that sort of a truce between the Commonwealth Division and the Chinese, I know not, but there was a certain respect there. And but you could come across some horrendous situations sometimes. It was always the thought of going out to capture prisoners. That was another objective during this static war. And we'd come up with this idea. I know I'd postulated the idea that as far as we were concerned, if you wanted to catch anybody that knew a lot about what was going on, a signaller was a pretty good bet, because they used to have all the information, certainly at company level, at their disposal. And if they operated the same way as we did, I thought, well, it wouldn't be a bad idea to go into their lines and cut all their telephone lines, if they've got the same as we have. And then they could, then we'd wait there until their signalers came along and started to repair the lines, and we could pop them on the head and capture them. And indeed, they did have lines, but I went out on a number of patrols to do this, and they were either defunct lines or they knew what was happening and they didn't bother to come out and repair them. But I remember on one occasion, we nearly walked into an ambush. We didn't, and I remember sort of dropping to, because if this happens, you sort of just disperse and lie low. And I was lying low, and I thought I was behind a heap of mud or something, and I was groping around at it, and terrible stench, and I realised I was sort of lying and embracing a rotten corpse. And I never really sort of, well, I was almost sick, I think, at the time, but I never thought any humanitarian things about it, except yuck, you know, what a terrible thing to be at yourself mixed up in. And I really was. I somehow, I seemed, doesn't matter what I was doing, I seemed to be getting more and more and more mixed up in it. But I reported it when we got back, that where I was at was, and I thought I knew where I was at. So the idea was to go out the next night, and I went back out to see if we could find this corpse. And it wasn't there. Now, whether or not it had been also, because there was wildlife galore there, you know, they used to chew up on corpses, so whether or not it had been... But there was remnants of an old Chinese strip of uniform there, so whether or not even the Chinese may have come and removed it. But we never found that again. Another patrol that I went out on, I went out with the American Rangers. There was some idea, this was also on 355, there was some idea that the whole division would come out of the line and be replaced by an American division, and then the Commonwealth would move up one to another place. Not quite sure whether this was to confuse ourselves, the enemy, or what, but that was the principle of rotation. And the American Rangers came up really to reconnoitre the valleys in front of 355. And along they came. We were in the reserve position at the time, and they were extremely well briefed on what they were doing. And the only fault that we found when they got there was the fact that they couldn't communicate with us because they hadn't got the appropriate radio sets, and they hadn't got the right frequencies. And of course you need to communicate with the regiment that you're working through. So good old Captain Scott volunteered me to go with them. And I found the whole exercise before going out very, very good. They were very patient. Everybody sat around a big circle, and maps were produced, and we were told exactly what we were going to do, how far the parameters would be, how far up to the Chinese lines we would go, etc., etc. And this was excellent. So night time came, and we got ourselves all dressed up, and off out we went through the minefield pass, because there were minefields in front of all the positions, and they used to have tape markings as to where was a safe point to go. And we got out through there, and it wasn't long before we walked straight into an ambush, and it was quite a firefight. And they, like us, had the usual thing of, if you've been ambushed, you just disperse and fall flat on your face. Unfortunately, I should have been with the ranger officer in charge, but when we dispersed, he went one way and I went the other. And we were all fighting, all, you know, the idea was you sort of disperse and face outwards so that you don't shoot each other. In general, that's the idea. And we used to work it quite well. I was not too certain about how the Americans were operating, because there seemed to be bullets coming from everywhere. And I remember this American shouting out, "Singler, Singler, where the fuck are you?" And I said, I'm over here. Bang, 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 bang. And he said, well, for Christ's sake, man, stand up. I can't see you. I said, if you want to see me, you fucking well stand up. Now, whether or not the the Chinese could speak English, I know, and I doubt it very much, but it seemed very funny to me that a split second after this, everything stopped. And the Chinese went. And we were left to our own devices. So we regrouped and decided that enough was enough and came back in. And we laughed our heads off when we got back in at the situation. And we went out the next night, and the officer said, right, now you and I are going to have, we're going to hold hands all the way through. He said, because I'm not losing you the next time. And okay, nothing happened in actual fact, and we went about our business and found out what they wanted to know. And the end product, of course, after it all was that the divisions didn't change. And when the Durhams went back in the line, the Durhams went back in again on 355, and we went the next time back to this forward position that I spoke about earlier on. So, there was some a few amusing things that came out of it afterwards. They weren't amusing at the time, but when you look back at it, the one of the things also I can remember in terms of doing daft things, I'm not too sure of the position that we were on, and it was certainly way after the time I've just described. It was coronation time, and we had one of the officers. His name was John Knott Bower. I believe his father was Sir John Knott Bower. But anyway, he got the grand idea. Why don't we go over to the Chinese lines, and with air identification panels, these were large nylon panels that you used to lay out on the ground to identify yourselves from air attack, so that people would know, or think they would know, not to attack you if you've got the right panel formation out, because the Chinese used to use the same sort of things. And why don't we go out and on the Chinese lines put a lovely E2R as to commemorate the occasion. So some of us, I was certainly included, to go out and reconnoitre the Chinese position to find out precisely where they were manning, and came back and said, okay, well, we think if you go there, you're all right. And lo and behold, out went John Knott Bower with his patrol, and on the morning of the coronation, there for all to see on the Chinese lines was this magnificent E2R. And just as we were admiring this, the divisional artillery thought that they would put on a show as well. And they started firing red, blue and white signal shells onto the Chinese. So the Chinese corresponded by blowing their bugles as loud as they could. So I think everybody had a bit of a fate that day. But, what would have happened if not Barrett's patrol had been zonked, I don't know. I mean, it would not have been so funny then. The other things that as signalers we used to have to do, we always used to have to be to make sure that we were connected to the next regiment to us. And in principle, you always connected up, you took charge of connecting up to the regiment on your left-hand side. So, and the next guy would sort of go to the left-hand side. And radio communication was no problem, except, of course, if you were positioned next to the Canadian 22nd Regiment, the Van Deux. It's the French-Canadian Regiment. Shocking people. And I got reasonable French from school, and so I used to try and call them up on the radio. But as I learned many, many years later, French the Canadian French is not quite as the same as pure French that you have in France. And we never actually struck up any real communication, but it was worth a try and caused a few laughs. But one of the principal things, and again, very nervous thing, because you were generally in full view of everybody, and you couldn't really do it at night for obvious reasons. You had to go and maintain the telephone wire communications, the high wire communications. So inevitably, signallers would set off with maybe one or two infantry guys to act as